Welcome to Buddha at the Gas Pump. I'm Rick Archer. My guest today is Lucas Bergenthal. And here's a brief bio of Lucas. 4 years ago, I experienced an awakening that opened up different worlds and granted me access to the Akasha through telepathy, leading to a higher state of consciousness. Since then, I have dedicated my time to integrating this experience and helping others identify past influences that hinder the realization of their soul's full presence. I also assist animals through telepathy. I conduct workshops on esoteric teachings gathered since my awakening, providing keys to help people find their way home. And more with Lucas in a minute. A couple of housekeeping points. You might want to visit the website if you haven't been there, if you're just watching this on YouTube, batgap.com, because there are all kinds of things there that you won't find on the YouTube channel. One of which is an AI chatbot that is called the Batgap Bot that has over 100,000 spiritual documents loaded into it. And you can have conversations with it that will be actually better than conversations you might have with ChatGTP or Copilot or one of those other AIs. And there's also a donate button, as there is now on YouTube. That's a new thing. It says thanks, I think, on YouTube. This program is made possible through the support of appreciative listeners and viewers. So if you appreciate it and would like to help support it, you could donate through PayPal on the Batgap website or through the little button on YouTube or through various other means, which you'll see on the donation page on Batgap. Okay, enough of that. Welcome, Lucas.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good to have you here. Lucas and I had a conversation earlier in the week. He's one of these people that I kind of feel like I know him. I think you'll get that feeling too. He's easy to know and kind of a kindred soul, I think, to all of us. So you're 29 years old, as I recall. Let's do a little bit of chronological bio first. I remember hearing you say that when you were a kid, you had perceptions of things that you just assumed that everyone had, but you later discovered they didn't. So what were you like as a little kid?
How I was as a little kid is the story from my parents, because I cannot remember it myself.
Right, me neither.
I have a few moments I can remember, but what is most easy for me to actually explain is my latest awakening, because that leads to how I was as a kid. If that's okay, I go
yeah,
that
sure.
way. I tried very much after I dropped school. I tried to fit in society, you know, with like figuring out what to do with life, try to be successful with this work or what to do. And the more I tried to seek success, the more I found this empty hole inside of me. And at one point I completely burned out and I went into a depression for a year where I only slept 2 hours a night. And it was actually one day when my parents, they came to me and they said, you know what, Lucas, there's something we have to tell you. We have to tell you something from when you were a child. Then they started to tell me how I often talked about past lives, how often, like my own past lives, when I was sitting and playing with my toys, I apparently said to my mom, like, Mom, now I know how I died in my past life. And then I told the entire story and such. And that was more like a daily routine that I often spoke about, either past lives or like what will happen in the future or seeing spirits, you know, when someone left the family, left the body, I like waking up the entire night, just like watching the spirits and such. So my parents, they often saw that there was something in me that was awakened to these worlds. And the more I tried to fit in society, the more I opened an emptiness inside of myself that kind of drained me. So that's how I was as a kid. I was able to see my past lives and I was able to sometimes get glimpses of the future, which would happen, which I said to my parents. Stuff like having a little brother or something. That's like a more classic one, but stuff like that. But also seeing spirits. That also made me afraid of the darkness when I was a kid. So yeah, was a lot of hindrances trying to fit into the world when you saw spirits also, right?
So, yeah, a lot of so-called spiritual people have a hard time fitting into the world. They go through a struggle when they're younger. In fact, you have a picture of St. Francis behind you. And I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Brother, Son, Sister, Moon about St. Francis. He came back from the Crusades and he was a sort of a macho guy. And then he got really sick. And then he came out of that and had this huge transformation. And then, you know, his father wanted him to work in the family clothing business or whatever it was. And in the movie, at least, he took off all his clothes and threw him around and just wandered off. But yeah. He just said, I can't make it in this world. I can't fit in.
somehow I'm trying to fit in a little bit more still than you do. I'm not walking around naked in the street, at least.
Yeah, well, if you did, you'd get a nice cozy jail cell sleep in.
Exactly. So one of the things that I'm very dedicated to today is to help people that also have openings, because there's so many people who has these kind of openings that it's so hard to fit into society. And it's about finding the balance, right? Because some people has an easier, even though they're like very awakened and, you know, they have these open abilities and such. So it's actually one of the things that I'm trying to really be in service of, because I know how devastating it can be if you don't know what's within you and you don't know how to react without you.
There's probably a lot of people watching today that feel that way. Incidentally, I didn't mention in the beginning that you're in Denmark, you're Danish, in case people are wondering what your accent is. So how do you help such people?
That's very difficult. That's the thing with the way I work. I don't have a formula of what I do. People sometimes call it soul therapy. I don't really have a name for it, but it's basically I'm trying to find the truth within them, which they are not able to see themselves. I know that sounds very normal or something, but that's like my go-to point. And then every session or every meeting I have with someone goes different ways. But there is, of course, these kind of fundamental parts that I'm using of myself. And I'm using, like you mentioned, I'm using telepathy and I'm using my opening to the Akasha and also my opening to the past lives, which I have today, to help these people seeing what's blocking them, what's causing suffering.
I actually figured you were going to say that it's different for different people, which makes sense. You know, you wouldn't obviously do the same thing with everybody. Can you think of a typical session that maybe you had recently, and just kind of give us a sense of how that went and what your experience was with the person, and maybe what you saw in a subtler way about them, and maybe what transformation, if any, they underwent?
Recently, I had a client that came to me and she saw one of my past interviews and she felt that kind of call. She didn't know what she came for. So I sat with her and she said, I don't know why I'm here, but I just feel like I need to have that session with you. And then for me, it's like I have to see the entire book of the soul's incarnation to figure out, okay, where is the chapter that something happened where we need to look into today to figure out what's blocking? So it's not like I see a book, but that's the best symbol. It's very subtle out there, so it's very hard to say. But I kind of like, I scroll in, like you have the book and you scroll in, and I'm like, okay, there's something here. I feel, okay, let's look into that. I basically read her without her saying anything, how she had problems in her relationship and how she had that she actually wasn't together with her husband anymore. And she was trying to seek love from others and at the same time, and why that happened. Because in her mind, she didn't know what was happening. She didn't see that there was something that caused her suffering. She just went to me because she said, I feel a call. I don't know what it is. Of course, I have suffering. I don't know what it is. And then I kind of guided in to see what it was. And then we went into, okay, what is this about? Because one of the things that I really try to do is always pull the energy back. So it's what's within you and never about the other person. That can be very triggering for a lot of people, because sometimes it's easier to put it to others. But I'm really trying to figure out what is the karmic pattern that is blocking you to see the truth within yourself in this situation that kind of sets you free. That's my belief, that when we see the truth and we become conscious about that truth and we accept that truth and we embody it, it can set us free.
I have a couple of questions about that. One is, when did you start picking up on people's past lives?
I became conscious about it 4 years ago in my awakening. I had a moment, I had an experience where all these kind of abilities came back to me because it got suppressed for a long time. So within
came back to you from previous lives or from your childhood?
From my childhood, but also more strong. I guess it's more strong than my childhood. It feels like that at least.
And even your childhood, you could say that was from previous lives. Yeah. You probably had this stuff developed back then.
Yeah, I believe so, because I know I've worked with it in past lives also, because, mm-hmm. you know, that's one of the first thing I saw was like a story of my soul's own incarnation into this world. Yeah, I believe so. When we are being born with these abilities, it's because the soul have already unlocked it in the past lives.
Yeah.
So,
and a general principle we could state here is that everybody comes into this life at a certain level of evolution, which is pretty much the level of evolution at which they left the last life. Pick up where you left off.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's exactly how I use this, like with the past lives. Because in the beginning, it was very hard for me to see if someone, when this opened within these 3 days, and, you know, I was walking on the street and I saw a man and I saw how he jumped out of a house in the past life, or like how he raped or murdered someone, you know. I saw these kind of things just walking on the street, seeing people.
Wow. Was it like constant and therefore really overwhelming, or just occasionally a flash?
It was constant in a way. If I walked with my dog, I could meet 20 people. I didn't see it with all 20, but maybe 5 or 10 of them, something like that.
You'd get some image of them jumping out of a window or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, when the telepathic ability opened, I also got the thoughts. It came like if they were also like suicidal or what they were thinking about. And often it was very dark what people are walking around thinking about. I took a lot of time to really isolate myself to figure out how can I
shut it down.
Train it so it will only be open when it's needed.
And so did you accomplish that?
Yeah, I did. It was a very intense half a year where I felt like a lot of joy and a lot of light to life vanished for a long time because it felt...
Picking up on all this stuff, yeah.
Yeah, it was very intense, very overwhelming, and, you know, all the dark stuff. But I went deep, and I actually, within half a year, I learned how to only open up. Not even when they asked me, but when they needed. Because, you know, I also figure out when people, you know, friends or like people in who's also like a seeker, and they heard about this, and they were like meeting me somewhere. They're like, can you tell me something about? I'm not doing it that way. It's only like if people come to me with like, and they really need help, they want to heal, then I'm opening up. I'm not opening up for fun.
Yeah, it's not a party game.
No.
You'd be a popular guy at parties. Yeah.
Well, that's the thing, right? I had to make a choice also when I saw that I could become very popular. Like I could feed the part of myself who could seek affirmation and such. And I need to drop that also and say, that's not the path I want to go. I want to go this one. And
yeah, I was thinking about that. Maybe it was after our conversation that we had the other day. And maybe you and I actually talked about it. Yeah, we did, because we talked about the story of Jesus after his 40 days and 40 nights in the desert being tempted by the devil, so to speak, and told that he could be famous and he could do all this stuff if he kind of got in league with the devil. And Jesus, I think that might have been the point where he said, "Get thee behind me, Satan." You know, he didn't fall for it. And I can think of examples of people who had some kind of spiritual awakening and gained some kind of powers, which were very attractive to people, and they abused them. They ended up using it as a tool for getting a lot of sex or taking advantage of people in different ways. And that to me is like a pitfall on the spiritual path, which results in a huge downfall that you got to make amends for, perhaps over many lifetimes later on.
Yeah, because you have a big responsibility when you open up to other people's energies. It's one of those things that can break my heart much today, actually, to see, because the more you unveil the illusion into the truth and you see all these layers, the more I've done that, the more I actually see that there's not many healers out there who's not kind of serving illusions, I could say that way, or serving like an unconscious pattern. Because the first experience I had with this was, I had my own kind of trip with this where I needed to figure out, and we can go into that later on, because I got tempted, and I got also, they also, like the darkness also tested me, you know, coming physically and, you know, with voices and such, really like try to break me.
The next question I'd like to ask is, what is the experience like for you of seeing a past life? And maybe you could compare it to something that people are familiar with. Is it like a dream where you have a dream and you visualize somebody's life? Obviously, it would be a waking dream because you're not asleep. Is it primarily a visual thing? Does it involve all the senses? How concrete is it? Or is it just really subtle and vague, like an intuition?
It's very different. There's many different ways I use it. Sometimes I use it consciously. If someone sits with me, I know at 3 o'clock today, I have a client and we sit today. So then I'm opening up myself. Sometimes things also come to me in my dreams or even in my knowing that there is something that I have to tell one of my students or one from my family, or, you know, something like that. So it works in very different ways. But I think what you also ask is like, for example, for my work, when I sit with people, how it comes to me that way. And it actually comes through impressions, through emotions. So the sensitivity that I have within myself, I feel those things within myself. And when I go into feel it, I see a storyline. I see a happening.
So it starts with a feeling, but then it also becomes visual.
Yeah, it can become visual. I don't really use the visual anymore because it's not really necessary. But yeah, it did for a long time. I just kind of like shut it off because there was no reason for it anymore. And it was a little bit of distraction from me being present in the moment. I trained it in a way to know that what happened in that past lifetime, for example, like this woman we talked about, you know, that she felt it was actually a part of her that cheated on her husband in another lifetime. And through that, she became a self-destructive pattern where she said, I would never deserve someone again. I will never deserve love again. And that emotion she gave birth to in that past life. And that was still running in her mind, like a voice saying, I don't deserve this. And I think many people, they know this. But for the specific karmic pattern of her, it was that emotion that she needs to go in and heal that voice. So that emotion is what I feel in my body. And when I feel that emotion, I see the knowing of what happened, the experience of how that kind of emotion was being born and it's running today.
Do you sometimes pick up on a series of lives for a person?
Yeah.
You might say, I was a murderer, but then in my next life, I was a doctor helping people to help atone for my having been a murderer. And then I did that. I mean, do you get a whole storyline going over many lives?
Yeah, I often try to narrow it into 10 lifetimes.
Wow. Even that's a lot.
Yeah, but I don't see the entire life, right? For me, it's just about figuring out what karmic pattern right now is blocking you for feeling more free. If I see, for example, that woman and she had that in another lifetime, I walk into the next lifetime or like I tap into that to see how did it affect that lifetime? How did it affect that lifetime? So I'm like jumping to see that karmic pattern, like tracing it to see how that unfolded in different lifetimes. So I don't go into other stuff. I don't go into stories about who she was, if she were a priest or queen or something. I don't care about that because it's not important. And that's one of the things that I realized myself, because many of my clients have also been people who have had past lifetimes where they heard that there was something very special. And then the ego starts to go into that. It's not always polite when I have to sit and say, I don't see that.
Yeah. Was it you I was talking to? I was talking to somebody and he was saying, it's amazing how many people thought they were Cleopatra.
I have had 30 of them or something.
Talk about multiple personality disorder. I mean, Cleopatra was a crowded body.
Yeah, exactly. One of the things that really drains me, because people come to me often to get confirmation, like I was this important. And I get it, because if we sit in deep suffering, it's very nice for the mind and for the emotions to feel like, you know what, in a past life, I was very important. Maybe I don't feel that important in this one, but I can rest in that. But it keeps holding us into pain. And it's kind of hard to break the illusion often, but like to be the dream crusher.
Well, I guess, you know, who was it? Emerson or Thoreau said, most men live lives of quiet desperation. A lot of people feel their lives are kind of mundane and boring and humdrum. And it's kind of a kick to think you might have been Mark Twain or Cleopatra or Napoleon or whatever. And this leads to an interesting question, which is how to discern between fantasy and reality. I think this is something you yourself must have to deal with, because I've heard you talk about Atlantis and living on other star systems and all that. Have you sometimes thought or realized that something you were thinking was actually just your imagination and maybe it's not true after all? And is that something you have to kind of keep your eye out for to make sure you don't do that?
I keep my eye out all the time. It's like a lifestyle. And that's also what I teach my students. You cannot conclude anything you see. Everything that I've said in my past, I cannot sit here today and say it's 100% the truth. I can only do my best always to serve, to see if it's the truth. And I always question myself to feel in, is there a part of me somehow that feels this is not fully aligned? And if there's just like 1% of that, I dive into that. Of course, it sometimes happens that I've seen, well, this thing might not be fully. I'm more careful when I sit here, for example, like in an interview, because I know that's going to follow me. But if I sit with a friend or something, I'm not as careful, but I'm more careful with what I say on interviews that I've really dived into that to see, okay, there's no part of me that feels any sort of disturbance or disharmony, because that's how it comes to me. if there is a part of my ego that wants to say, like part of the personality that wants to say something, that's why I know it's like part of the imagination. So yeah, it's like a full-time job to always question everything that comes, because things come down all the time. That's my daily life. It just comes down, right? So I have to filter through.
That's really good. And I'm glad to hear you say that, because I know people and I've interviewed people who don't seem to be able to distinguish between reality and fantasy, or between imagination and something that might be true. I remember this one guy who lived in Sedona. Anything that popped into his head, and he had a good imagination, he assumed to be true, and he was just kind of making stuff up. And, you know, some of the stuff I knew historically and factually was absolutely untrue. So, you know, what purpose does that serve? And, you know, the whole New Age world is full of all kinds of fascinating stuff. But as someone put it, it's Hostess Twinkies for the mind. I don't know if you have Hostess Twinkies in Denmark, but they're like these snack foods that are real tasty, but absolutely no nutritional value.
Yeah, that's it. That's a perfect symbol. Yeah, I love that. Yeah, no, that's true. It's true. I also see, was your truth at one point, like the more you dive in and the more you seek within for like finding the truth within yourself, you also realize, of course, there's things you said a couple of years ago that maybe was true at that point, but now you just hit a new layer where that thing is not fully like resonating with you anymore.
That's good. I don't know if you've ever heard of Aldous Huxley, but he was a philosopher and all. And he said an interesting thing about the scientific revolution. He said that the greatest innovation of the scientific revolution was not the steam engine or the accurate clocks or anything like that. It was the development of the working hypothesis. Because we came out of an age, the Middle Ages, where all kinds of religious dogma were considered to be true, and you could be killed if you questioned them. And so the scientific revolution gave people the liberty to question everything. And that's kind of the way I do it myself. If somebody tells me they see angels or that beings exist on the Pleiades or whatever, I think, okay, that's an interesting working hypothesis. Let's see how much evidence we can find for it. And maybe we can, maybe we can't, but I'm not going to just absolutely believe it or absolutely reject it. And different things have different degrees of evidence, different degrees of credibility. If somebody tells me the earth is flat, sorry, I really don't think it is. But if they say alien beings have been visiting the earth, yeah, there seems to be a lot of evidence for that. So it's kind of like a matter of living your life around what you can really know through experience rather than just imagining things.
Yeah, I agree. For example, what I've realized is often like when I get these things, especially when it's something where I feel, okay, this could be on the edge, right? When we talk about past civilizations or something, I'm trying to be very careful with what I say, because I don't want to feed into like the entire thing you mentioned. You know, I cannot remember the name, but that beautiful symbol you use with that dessert thing.
The Hostess Twinkie.
Yeah, exactly. I don't want to feed that. So I'm trying to be very careful with that. But one of the things that I, for example, realized was I know that when I remembered some past lives where I could see that there was evidence behind it somehow, I knew how that felt in my body. So I was trying to be very cautious with how the different impressions that came from cosmos, how it felt in my body. And suddenly I realized, okay, there's a part that feels this way and there's a part that feels this way. And this way I might be more cautious about, where this way I'm still cautious, but I know this feeling, there might be more resonance with it. So I dive into that. One of the things, for example, that I realized was how there's different kind of civilizations of Atlantis. And one of the things that came to me was what is important for me to know with that is not to feed into this and this about that and that that's important, but more like to understand that there was a part in the Atlantean time where they were more in a dreamy state than they were in a waking state, like a waking state like we sit today and feel like we are. It's more like the consciousness was flowing and the cosmos was flowing with everything. And for me, the message was to spread that. And I didn't fully share that until I realized that there was also saints from East that often said, like, you are closer to the truth when you're actually sleeping. So I start to like try to find other kind of evidence that someone says the same before I take it out, if it makes sense.
No, that makes a lot of sense. I have long debates with skeptical and atheistic friends about this kind of thing. Speaking of Aldous Huxley, there's the idea of the perennial philosophy, where people all over the world in different cultures that had no way of communicating with each other came up with similar ideas about the nature of reality. And it lends credence to their theories or their philosophies. People are actually cognizing this kind of thing in every culture, in every age.
I cannot sit here also and say that I have seen the full truth. People need to resonate with what I say. And if they don't resonate, it's just like, drop it. You know, don't spend time on it. I got that confirmation. Like, I've always felt like that, you know, and people can be very intimidated when they sit with me, because some people, they might ask questions. And when I'm private with some friends or something, and they ask me questions, often I answer. But people can also be very intimidated and say, how do you know that? And I'm like, well, you don't have to believe it. Yeah. I mean, just drop it if you don't believe it. I'm not sitting here and saying that this is like the truth and you have to follow it, because I don't believe so. I believe that there's so many perceptions of life, and I feel like I'm just still a student of that. I don't know anything at all. It's like, the more I realize stuff, the more I realize that I don't know anything.
That's a great attitude. I think that might be what the Zen people meant by beginner's mind. No matter how advanced you are, it's actually good to have beginner's mind.
Makes sense.
To have the attitude of a beginner. Because it's true. I mean, relative to what could be known, possibly, nobody has more than a tiny fraction.
Yeah, exactly. And that's beautiful.
In any field, like science. I mean, Albert Einstein probably would admit that he's at the base of the mountain in terms of what could ultimately be known.
Yeah. And it's beautiful, right? It's beautiful that
yeah. We
get to like find the different puzzles. And even when we feel like we have put it all, it's just like, we take that break, and suddenly we have the puzzle, and we realize that puzzle is only like a break to another one, and that's like, it keeps going that way.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. It
makes really life interesting.
Yeah, it does.
Well, let's take Atlantis as an example. Obviously, we've heard a lot about Atlantis. Annie Besant and the Theosophical Society and all kinds of people have been talking about it for a long time, and I guess there are myths going back to ancient civilizations talking about it. And that for me is one of those things where, I don't know, it's an interesting working hypothesis. Maybe it's all just myth, or maybe there actually was such a place and there will eventually be some kind of archaeological or geological discovery that will confirm it or at least lend evidence to it. What is your thinking on that? I mean, you've had subjective experiences about it. I've heard you say things about it, but where was it supposed to be and when did it supposed to end?
I think I want to start by saying that I actually agree with you in the way that it's not really important for me if it happened or not happened. Uh-huh. It's more like when it comes to me this way, there is a message that we should use today. What if it didn't happen? Honestly, I don't even care, because what happened in the past, and this is why it's also not so good for my business of doing past life stuff, I don't care about the past anymore because I don't believe that the past exists anymore. But at the same time, I get these kind of messages, like there's something happened in the past that you can use today to help people get deeper into the now, to like be more soaked into the now. I just wanted to say that. But as I see it with Atlantis, like Atlantis had three different kind of civilizations. Like there's different timelines.
Is what you're about to say all coming from something you have cognized or something you read?
No, I am not a good reader.
So you didn't read about this. This is something that came to you subjectively.
Exactly. When I get something, I try to find it in the books to get confirmations, but I don't know where to search, right? So I have a lot of books and sometimes, you know, I sit here and there and of course I still read to like also learn myself. Mm-hmm. That's very important for me, but I'm not a big reader. So I haven't read any about this, no.
You should try the Batgap bot. Ask that your questions.
We'll do that. We'll do that.
Keep going.
Perfect. The thing that I saw was... And there was three different timelines of Atlantis. And I saw this because the way I use telepathy is not only for me communicating with a dog or a horse or another human being. It's actually like telepathy is the connection between the soul and the human. Because there's a consciousness and and between two souls, there's a consciousness and consciousness. And that thing that relates those two is telepathy. It's like a communicative bond, you can say. Mm-hmm. So when I got shown these things, it was like, I was being taught. I had the opening in these 3 days and everything open. And then I went to school. I went to class, you know, to learn all these things. And what I saw was that there was three different civilizations of Atlantis. And this was important to understand the development of the human being, how the chakras were developed, because the different chakras has a different kind of telepathic vibration to use in different kind of healing techniques, different kind of ways to communicate with the cosmos, if it makes sense.
So far, so good.
So as I saw it, there's three different stages of Atlantis. There was one long time ago where the soul started to take a physical form. And that was like what we call, I don't know what the English word for that is. It's not instincts. It's like, you know, the self-preservation, what you call it, you know, the when the animals also, you know, they produce again and again. You, it's a little bit like instincts. I don't know the English word, actually.
Well, that's a good word. I mean, okay, the soul started to take a physical form. In other words, souls prior to that were existing as souls without a physical form, but they wanted to incarnate, embody, in order to be able to function in a more material realm.
Yes. Okay. And the first thing that kind of got evolved was this kind of instincts, you know, the instincts. So it was like this, as I saw it, it was like this plasmic thing, you know, from being an ether to this plasmic before it manifested into the physical. And the first thing that got evolved was the consciousness of the instincts in that physical being. So I saw that to like understand how the instincts work, because I got shown this for understanding how important the instincts are to follow today, what to follow, what not to follow. It's like a compass. If we should use the term that the soul is out in the cosmos, it's out in the ether, and it's communicating down to the body to say, you have to go this way to come home, because right now you're trapped, you're lost, you have to go this way. There's part of the instincts that helps you follow that way.
Yeah.
We're very disconnected from the instincts today because of the way we live.
Intuition is another good word here.
Yeah. But I don't use that word for this for another reason, because we come into that. I see it like there's different kind of ways as telepathy, like I said. So the instincts is associated with the solar plexus chakra when we talk about chakras. So I saw this to understand, okay, if I start to understand the consciousness of my solar plexus chakra, I can start to follow the instincts that something from the cosmos is showing me to go that way. And that's what I do today. It's also what you can call spontaneously living, right? It's not like I jump out of the cliff if I feel like my instinct tells me that. And it's not like it's not like that, but there's a very delicate part of the instincts that actually show you the way back. And I say way back because I believe that today we are just confused, but we already know everything. We just need to realize it again. So that's why I say it's like a way back, like a remember. But at the same time, cosmos always evolves. So that's the paradox. That was like the first civilization. But I saw like there was three different kind of civilizations of Atlantis. The intention with what I share now is to understand that I saw that because I saw the development of the human being with the different kind of energy forms and to use that to help people find back. So that's why when I sit and I talk about my sessions, is talking about that past life, that's very conditioned because many things happen. Like I don't speak with the person about where I sit and have a telepathic communication with the energy system and the chakras to start to awaken this.
I'm not entirely clear on the last point you made, but keep going, keep explaining. Okay.
When I do sessions with people, I said for the human being, I talk about the past life with the trauma, with the identification, with these karmic blockages. But at the same time that I sit and speak with that, I use a telepathic connection to talk with the energy system, you know, the being, the different chakras, because I believe that all the chakras in the person, as I see it, they have their own kind of vibration.
So you're picking up on two sources of knowledge. One is you're tuning into some past lives, and the other is you're tuning into maybe their subtle body, the different energy centers in the body, which they might not even be aware of. And then another thing I've heard people say is that the dweller in the body, anybody's body, is actually just a tiny subset of the total soul, and that our full potential as a soul couldn't possibly even be contained in this body, which reminds me of that line from Star Wars where Obi-Wan Kenobi said to Darth Vader, "If you strike me down, I shall become more powerful than you can possibly imagine." I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you're sort of tuning into this sort of higher soul or higher self or larger reality of what the person is than they themselves realize.
Yes. And I believe myself, that's why the sessions has these beautiful miracles happening sometimes. Like this woman I shared with you, she just broke down completely and said, "I've spent 40 years trying to go to psychotherapy, trying to go this, and you spent 1 hour and you healed me. What did you do?" And I was like, "I didn't do anything. It was something in you that opened. I cannot force an opening. I can just invite it. But if the person is ready, it happens." So it's like, I didn't do it. It's not me. It's actually you who did it. That's very important for me to remember and also like always share that I'm not doing anything. I'm inviting something, but it's only when the person is ready.
You're a catalyst.
Yeah.
You know how a catalyst works. It sort of facilitates the chemical reaction without interfering with it or something. It just enables it to happen in a way that it otherwise wouldn't.
Exactly. This is how I use telepathy. I use it for the cosmic consciousness and the cosmic being, the subtle body to open. But people get freaked out. I see people, they are afraid to like come close to me because they feel like, oh, he's reading my mind.
And
like,
he's going to hear all my dirty thoughts.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes there's like when I've been out traveling and do workshops, and some from the workshops, they come to introduce their kid to me. And then the mother says, and this guy, he's the one doing telepathy. Like the kid is standing behind the mother saying, I don't want him to read my mind. And
People can do that kind of thing. I was seeing Amma one time, you know, Amma, the so-called hugging saint. And I was sitting with a friend about 30 feet away from her off to one side. And she was sitting on the couch doing her thing and music's playing and she's hugging all these people and everything. And I started telling this friend something I really shouldn't have started to tell him. And she just turned and stared at me like, cut it out, you know? And I said, okay. And I just stopped telling the guy.
But that's actually, if we can go a little into that, because now when we talked about instincts, and we talked about intuition, where I said, for me, intuition is a little bit different than the instincts, because one of my practices, so to speak, is that I believe that telepathy is its own kind of cosmic being. It's like a consciousness that connects to consciousness. Soul and a human and a soul. There is a consciousness that connects all these kind of things, like a web that makes us able to relate to each other and communicate, not only physically and like with using the voice, but also emotionally and thinkingly and intuitively. For example, when I devote myself, I'm like the same way as St. Francis said, Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace. I devote myself to that consciousness to say, I don't know what I need to do. You know, and I just follow that. I'm not reading people's mind. But very often what I say, people say, oh my God, I thought about that. And they say, you read my mind. I said, no, I don't. This is intuitive telepathy for me, because intuition is between two souls when they relate towards each other. I don't know what's happening up here in the soul's level. I'm in the physical. But if I connect to this, I'm in the cosmic flow. So what those people might think about, I can also think about, but it's not necessarily that I know they think about this. For me, that's like working with intuition, if it makes sense. It's following the cosmic flow that is not my intuition. It happens through me and I'm just following it.
It reminds me of trees. I have this book, I think it's called The Wisdom of Trees, that Pamela Wilson sent me. She's been on Bad Gap a couple of times. There's this whole thing about how, I think it's called the mycelium or something. There's this whole network of fungi or something that's under the ground. It's like the internet for trees, and all this information gets passed through it. And like, if there's some kind of infestation of some beetles or something that are going to hurt the trees, the word spreads around the forest and the trees can maybe develop some kind of chemical to repel the beetles or something. Or if there's a drought or all kinds of other things like that, but they actually have this network of communication. And so we do too, in terms of the collective consciousness, as Jung put it, Carl Jung, or some deep level at which we're actually all the same person. And therefore, telepathy is probably mediated through that deep underlying field.
Yeah, exactly. Many spiritual teachers, they also say your thought is not yours, right? It just happened through you. But we somehow intend to personalize it. And the more we personalize it, the further away we come from telepathy. Because we're not connected to that, we go into our own little bubble. So that also means like when I go like through a process myself, when there's like a trauma or grief or something, and I know that I identify even more now with like the thoughts and the personality and all these kind of things, I have to close for that, because I don't know if it's the cosmic flow that comes through me. It's probably my own kind of things I have to cleanse out again and purify again. It's that part where the thoughts that comes to you is a cosmic flow, but the more we identify with it, the further away we come from being with that flow somehow. The thought still comes. That's what I realized. The thought still comes, but if you don't identify with them, you can actually use them for a way better purpose. You don't have to figure stuff out.
It's another way of putting it. If the wave realizes that it's really the ocean and it's actually essentially one with all the other waves, even though they appear different on the surface, then I'm not sure what the utility of that would be, but at least it's a more realistic vision of what's going on, instead of the wave thinking, okay, I'm this isolated wave and I'm completely separate from that wave over there and that wave over there. They're not, and it's not the reality.
No, exactly. And that's actually why for me, when I go through a process and I feel like I'm being tested and like losing faith and all these kind of things, it's actually like going back to this connection with the telepathic cosmic consciousness to feel like I'm going back to the flow, because then I'm not trying to figure stuff out by myself, because the more I do that, the more I separate and believe I'm just a wave.
Yeah.
Not just a wave. So I'm trying to get back to that sometimes. I've realized I don't need to figure stuff out about traumas, and I don't need to figure anything out. I just need to let that flow happen because it purifies itself. Mm. And that's pretty beautiful, actually.
Are you aware of the work of Rupert Sheldrake?
No.
He's been on BatGap. He's this British scientist who has been studying what he calls morphogenetic fields and how there's different fields, actually, for different species and for kind of more universal field for everything and things like that. And he gives examples of how certain ideas will crop up independently to different people. For instance, Sir Isaac Newton developed calculus, but some other guy developed calculus at the same time without collaborating with Newton. And there have been other things like that. And then he wrote a book called Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home. He actually studied this very carefully, where the owner would do something very unpredictable or take a taxi, and then they observe the dog, and the dog would be like waiting at the door. It would get up and go as soon as the owner was intending to come home. And I mean, our dog, if we even think that we maybe should take a walk, the dog will come running down the hall.
Right. You know? Yes. You have to be aware of what you're thinking, because if you just think about it, you're not doing it, you're going to disappoint your dog, right?
Exactly. In fact, Irene gets upset with me if I even say the word walk or give any kind of hint, because then if we're not going to actually do it, the dog will be very disappointed. We have a very psychic dog. You'd like it.
Yeah. And they are great teachers. My dog was also very psychic. He was the one that really taught me about telepathy from one being to another, because what I was thinking, he picked up immediately, no matter what it was, you know. So yeah. I feel like I really have to be aware of what I'm thinking, because I don't want to hurt him, you know. I don't want to harm him and such. So that was like a great Zen teacher, I could say.
You know, and he knows how to spell too. Like, he's afraid of flies, because I think he's afraid of the fly swatter, because we get it out to swat the fly. Mm. So then we started spelling it FLY, but then he picked up on that. We can't even say FLY anymore. So now we call him Hank. Hey, Hank's in the house.
Exactly. The beauty of this is that there's so much to learn from animals. There's so much to learn from animals, because they don't have that idea of like the personality, the ego, I want to call it now. I know there's many animal therapists and also other telepathy people out there who says that they have an ego. I don't believe so, because I don't see an animal that says, I am sad. Sadness just happens in them. They don't say, I am happy. Happiness just happens in them. So for me, there is not an I that identify with it. It just happens. That's the flow. And when you are in that flow, you pick the impressions of others also, right? Because we all have that kind of emotional body. We all have the subtle body, the aura field that radiates out what we think and what we feel. And it's like a radio station. And they're just so open that, for example, when you say FLI, you think about the fly, which means that that impression goes straight in. Doesn't matter what you say. They pick that up, because what you sense, what you think, hear, and feel, they pick it up and they learn the words to put it into that. So that's it's a beautiful example.
It's funny you brought up the radio station, because I was just thinking that as a good analogy for what you've been describing, which is that the radio doesn't create the music. The radio is just a medium or a interface with the electromagnetic field, which, you know, other radios can also access and express the same music or different music if they're on a different frequency. So I think what you were saying in the last few minutes is that your ability to do this stuff is not your ability. It's more like you're just an instrument. Again, yeah. Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace. You're just an instrument for this. And with that orientation, you know, you have the right intentions and motivations. And if you began to appropriate it, like, oh, I'm special, then you'd get in trouble.
Yes, exactly. Because like I see it, it's not special to be telepathic. Like I said, we all have it. Your consciousness, I'm a consciousness, that connects us is the telepathic bond, which means that I'm not special because I pick up on it. We all pick up on it. I've just focused on maybe learning to feel it even more, but we all pick up on it all the time. All the time, we pick up the telepathic impressions.
You can see how there could be civilizations, or have, perhaps have been, in which people don't need to talk out loud because they're just so tuned in, like a couple who's been married for so many years, they can sort of pick up on each other's thoughts or whatever. But even more developed, you might imagine there are species who don't even have vocal cords, you know, because they're just so good at telepathy is the way they function.
Yeah, exactly. And I believe there is both out in space that there's many, many species that don't need a voice because they are so profound in this. They don't need to talk. They're just in communication with each other. And I also believe there are also beings on this earth that does the same. Look at the way that some birds, they're dancing with each other in these big groups, right?
Oh, the starlings. It's called a murmuration of starlings, where thousands of them just all move in synchrony. And scientists actually don't know quite how they do that.
Exactly. That's what I call telepathy.
We were talking earlier about Atlantis and things like that, whether it's a myth and so on. Recently, a friend was telling me about Joseph Campbell's The Power of Myth series, which I had known about, but I've never actually sat down and watched it. But I want to do that. I want to make a point to watch it. He was a friend of George Lucas, actually, and it was a lot of inspiration for the Star Wars series. In a way, it almost doesn't matter whether something really happened or whether it's just a myth, because it can have the same value for the society either way.
Yeah, exactly. When I began to get this from Atlanteans, I felt like if people don't believe me, I took it very personal in the beginning. But I learned within a couple of years, because I knew with myself, you know, it doesn't really matter if it's like if it happened or not happened. It's like the message that comes with it. It's like that's important because the message that comes with it is something we need to use today. It doesn't really matter if it happened or not. And honestly, there's too much curiosity that dwells upon the past in ancient civilizations. I understand because it's also like finding back to being more in flow and such. But like you said, it doesn't always serve the best to dwell too much in the past.
Or the future?
Exactly. I believe that's a separation. It's like the full separation we have of like being with the one beloved. That's what I call the cosmos and what people would call God also and these kind of things. I believe that separation, the more we understand, the more we realize, because it's easy to sit mentally and say, well, the past doesn't exist and the future doesn't exist, right? But fully experience it, that's another thing. But first for that, we need to drop the seeking of these two things. The personality really wants to hold on to it.
Which is not to say we can't learn from the past. Someone said those who forget the past or don't learn from history are doomed to repeat it. Obviously, we can learn what is a good thing to do and what's not a good thing to do based upon what past people have done. So I don't think that's what you're saying, right?
No. I mean, more in the way of what I felt in the past, or, you know, like sometimes we hold on to the past too much. That's what I mean. Like, to reflect upon the unconscious patterns to enlighten them into consciousness.
Like if we lament over our childhood and what our parents did and that kind of thing and just keep obsessing about that when we're 50 or 60 years old.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's what I mean. I've seen that also with many people. They go to breathwork every week and they go to ayahuasca 10 times a year to heal the same trauma. They hold on to that past so much that they kind of feed it again. They feed the same trauma by trying to heal it.
Because you put your attention on it, and that to which you put your attention grows stronger in your life.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what I mean, because I totally believe, and I do that with myself all the time, I reflect upon the past to see unconscious patterns. And I also reflect upon the things that I see and that we can learn from history and we can learn from all these things. So I believe that's important, but it's like embodied into this moment.
Okay, so if dwelling on past situations only reinforces them and is not really the best way of resolving such traumas, what is the best way or most efficient way? Let's say you go to a psychotherapist or something and you're talking about all your childhood issues and things like that. And you go on for years, like that lady said, she's been to therapist for years and never gotten anywhere and perhaps actually reinforced stuff. If that's really an inefficient way of going about it, what is a more ideal way of resolving past traumas? Because we do carry them. They do lodge in our systems.
Of course, I also believe that the trauma, like the energy, I see that also, like the energy is inside the body. There is like an energy. So of course, it can help to do some kind of work for that. But one of the things that I think I want to say is that for me, there's a difference between emotions and feelings and thoughts. And I see that. That's one of the things that I use in my workshops also, where emotions is like the wave. It comes like waves, where thoughts and feelings, they're like the energy pattern is like a circle. So what I used to say is like you're running the hamster wheel. So the more you think about it, the more you're just like running around and like you're just nourishing that the same thing. And what I realized with myself was, let me say it this way. I realized how many incarnations I've had, which means that we all have, that this little incarnation we have right now is just like a blink of an eye.
Right.
Then it's over, right? And then we have a new one. How important is this incarnation? It's not that important. That's what I realized. So why would I spend time on dwelling with something where it will already be somehow forgotten in the next one? Then I know, okay, then we have the next one. And that's why I say I work with 10 past lives. It's just 10 blink of an eye. It's not that much from the perspective where I see it. So why would I spend so much time trying to figure it out? Instead, I see myself an experience. I see myself as a soul having an experience, like an experiment also. So instead of trying to figure out the content of the trauma, for example, I'm more interested in the mechanics of the mind. You know, I'm studying like, oh, now I'm going this way. There's like part of my personality that goes this way, a part of it that goes this way. And every time I do this, I actually go into the faith to the divine. Whenever it's ready to be taken, just take it. I know it's very easy to say this way. And of course, for every situation, it's a little bit different. But that's like the main practice to say for me. I'm not trying to figure it out with the mind because then I'm nourishing it. I am looking into it and I'm feeling it. And through the feeling, I'm finding into the place where I feel I'm ready to give it over. And if I'm not ready to give it over, it's fine. We cannot like rip it off, right? It's like if we would rip off like the mold of the snake before the mold was ready. It happens when it happens. That's my faith. When it's ready, it will drop.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you said that it's easy for you to say. You said something like that because you said something like it's easy for me to say, or maybe I was just thinking that. But there's a difference between a description and a prescription. So you can describe how you operate, how you function, but then if you're going to be a teacher of some kind, then how do you empower or enable other people to achieve the same perspective? Maybe they need meditation, maybe they need some techniques, maybe they need this, that, or the other thing. They can't just copy your way of thinking without being in your state of consciousness.
Yeah, this is why my work will go more and more over to have more students, which I can initiate in my cosmic consciousness, the opening I have.
How can you initiate them? How can you impart it or convey it?
It's a way of being part of their daily life, you know, with the things they go through. I see the human body as a filter. A student comes to me and then that student, it's like an apprenticeship. It's not like you take a course in 1 week and then you initiate it or something. It's like I'm part of the flow of your life. And through that, we see what kind of test that the cosmos and the universe puts into you to see how can this situation help you purify your filter even more. Because the more purified the filter is, the more I have experienced myself that what doesn't serve you anymore that way, it will drop when it drops. Because like I see, even every feeling is its own intelligence. And that intelligence, what I have discovered is that even that feeling, it doesn't want to hold on. It's not like it wants to hold on. I'm not talking about the thought now. I'm talking about the emotional trauma that happened. That has its own intelligence. I believe everything has its own intelligence. The stone has its own intelligence. The water, of course, we have scientific proof of that today. But I also believe that the feelings have, because that's what I see. That's what I feel. That's what I work with. I don't see that even the feelings wants to feel stuck there, you know? I believe that everything is always seeking towards freedom, towards liberation. So it's like corroborating with that. Of course, it's about giving love to everything, and that sounds very easy and like cliche, but it's more about helping people to opening up for themselves to that which they need to open up to through cosmos so they can be a filter. Because then things being taken when it doesn't serve them anymore. Because often these traumas is also what locks us to not being fully open to these kind of abilities. Because if we use it from a traumatic point of view, we don't know if we're serving illusions or we're serving the truth.
Yeah, your statement, the feeling has its own intelligence. Some people have experienced that they actually are possessed in a way by things, and they don't realize it until the thing comes out or releases. And then they actually realize that there was some kind of entity that was occupying, at least in part, their makeup. And there might be many entities, and they have to be purified or purged. So that's one way of looking at it. It can be looked at in other ways, like just neurophysiological or something. Like in the Bible, you think about Jesus releasing or casting out demons, and the demons are clinging, holding on, but ultimately you get the impression they're happy to be cast out because it was a miserable existence, being a demon tormenting or occupying somebody.
This is a big question, and for that we need to go deeper into the entire game of the darkness. We can go that way. I would love to go that way.
Yeah, let's get into it.
For me, I try to separate it between darkness and evilness. I try to conceptualize it this way for like the mind to understand it better, where I see darkness as lower entities of a lower consciousness that doesn't know better.
Right.
So, for example, when these kind of entities, like this feeling, it comes into you, they often comes through the astral plane, because mm-hmm. the astral plane is where the feelings get manifested. So through our astral body, these feelings, they pop in, and we, in the mind, we start to identify with it. This is why astral travel is like, we need to be careful what we are doing, and that's also why we need to be careful with the plant medicine, what we're doing, because we don't know what we open up to, and we get stuff down, and even when we feel good right after, you don't know what's going to happen in next life because you put something in. I'm harsh with that because I've seen so much of this, and it breaks my heart that people don't know what they're doing, actually. But this kind of things is like the lower conscious entities. They are still like serving the light, if we should use that concept. They just don't know better. If one conscious being is here and another one is up here, this conscious being cannot see that one up here, because if it could see it, it will be up here. That feeling feeds of what it knows. If that feeling feeds of jealousy, if it feeds of anger or something, because that's what it knows, it just needs to preserve itself the same way as we need. We need food, we need love, we need this and this and whatever we need. That's where we are. That feeling only know one thing to feed off, and that's what it's activate in us. But that doesn't mean it serves the bad in us. Sometimes they don't even want to be there. They just like they have to exist. They have to feed itself, to nourish itself. Because when it actually does this, like the next step for it might be another feeling that might be a little bit more high vibrant or whatever we should call it. And suddenly it evolves. So I don't see that darkness as being bad. I just see it as a lower consciousness that needs to be enlightened.
They're trapped in the role. It's kind of like I'm reminded of, again, I can think of Star Wars today for some reason, but when Darth Vader finally got killed, he finally broke free of his Darth Vader role and realized his original consciousness and was grateful for being liberated that way.
Exactly. And this is why I think I can share this now. I haven't shared it before, but I have also done something that would look like exorcism in today's society. But I would not call it exorcism because people, they judge it to understand like it's the devil and people feel so bad about it. Well, that's not how I see it. I see a feeling that completely corrupts the person in the moment. Sometimes I can use like a telepathic connection. I'm not that skilled that I can do it every time. That will be amazing, but I'm not that skilled, and I'm not sure it's my path either. Sometimes when I can pick up that frequency, I can communicate with it and then it pops up. And what I realize is often when it pops up, that the person, sometimes they sleep, sometimes they can't even remember it. Sometimes they can remember. It's very different compared to where they are themselves. But it comes up because it also wants to be set free. So it's actually like a corporation. So that's why I can, of course, not call it like exorcism. But it's a little bit the same, because something like an entity leaves the body and it doesn't feel good in the moment. It doesn't. It does feel good afterwards.
Yeah, afterwards, yeah. I mean, can that be dangerous for you, locking horns with these entities?
Not this one. This is very calm because they don't have any bad intention. When we talk about evilness, it's different. Then I need to be way more aware. Because evilness is that which is conscious, but just choose it in another way.
When you think about it, anything that's negative or evil, any person, any being which is playing a negative role, it's not their ultimate destiny. And therefore, it's not ultimately what they really want to be doing. They're just in it at that time. And as Jesus said, forgive them, Father, they know not what they do. You wouldn't want to be one of the guys nailing him to the cross, or you wouldn't want to be a guard in a Nazi death camp. But people have gotten stuck in these dark destinies, dark roles. And ultimately, everyone needs to be liberated from all such things and rise to their full height of possibility.
Yeah, And that's exactly where something like traumas and these kind of wounds can really, they can really call upon bad energy that sucks the life out of you, if I should use that dramatic phrase. But that's what I see sometimes. But at the same time, we should not judge what is evil, because let's be honest, most of us have had troubles in our life where we have an argument with someone, maybe an ex-lover or a friend, and it never really got healed. So that person might see you now as someone that was manipulative or narcissistic or something, and you maybe see that person as the same. Who's right in this? There's two different perceptions seeing the same kind of reality in the middle. Who's right? So we can never know what actually is like. What is evilness? Look at what happened with Jesus. People thought he was evil. You have seen that with many masters afterwards. Many have been executed for the same.
Change of topic. We've talked about cognizing the past and you cognizing past lives and all that stuff. Do you ever have future visions, feelings for what might be happening in the next several decades or whatever?
Yeah, but I have a lot of those, but I'm very careful with saying it because I know that the future is always in movement. So I'm not one of those who use it to like talk about futures. I don't believe so. It's very, very rare that I do that, because if I say something, people might cling to it. And I don't want that, because then they cling to something that I could see wrong, or maybe it just changed because something happened and the future changed. So I'm very cautious with talking about that. But yeah, I have the visions and I have many of them.
A lot of people seem to feel, and actually a lot of ancient traditions have said, that we might be heading into some very dark times, difficult times. A lot of people might die, you know, whether it's climate change or plagues or whatever. But that if we get through all that, there'll be a very bright future, some kind of age of enlightenment or something. Does that concur in general with your vision?
Yeah, it actually does. And it began when I had that opening. I saw, oh my God, this world is like going a very dark place now. It's like, it's not going to be easier right now. And I felt so hopeless until I realized we just have to dive very deep so we can come up on the other side.
Yeah.
And that's why I don't resonate with all these kind of challenges that says that some galactic federation will come and save us in 3 months from now or something. We have to dive deep. And honestly, somehow the deeper we go, the more we can also grow the other way, right? It's like the native, they speak about the tree, the deeper the roots are, the taller the tree can be. The mysticism, they also talk about, you know, the deeper you go in your unconsciousness, the more the consciousness can grow. It's like different concepts, but it's the same truth they talk about. And I see the same, like, we are going a very, very tough place, but I believe it's for the better good. But right now, it's about centered in the heart and being humble. And
you know, my feeling is that the more spirituality can be infused into the collective consciousness, the less difficult it will have to be.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And right now we just see that the spirituality just bursted up, in especially in the hippie times, right? Where we walk from the suppression, and then suddenly this beautiful kind of love and peace and all this harmony started to come. And now there's like this pattern of this commercialized spirituality where it's not so much about actually meeting yourself. It's more about feeding the personality in some ways. But again, if you see it from a higher perspective, which I always try to do, I just see it's like, it's just a phase. Yeah, it's just a phase. And it just has to happen because the spiritual entity, if we could say it that way, it's not the best way to say it, but it also has to evolve down here with all the human beings. And we have to integrate and process it. And of course, the ego needs to take a little ride with that also and feel good and special clothes and all the malas and being the best and all these kind of things, right?
Yeah. This question may be outside your expertise, but it relates to what we're talking about. Do you feel that there have to be cycles? And obviously there are cycles, so maybe there have to be. But very often after a big war, everything gets better again, like, you know, World War II. And now Germany and Japan are close allies. It was a horrible thing to have gone through, but now those countries are not apparently inclined to behave that way anymore. Do you have any thoughts about that perspective?
Yeah, I think I want to bring it back to ancient civilizations again just a little bit, because one of the things that I see is that when a group of conscious people reach a very high enlightened state, it cannot stay like that. It has to drop again. We saw that with Atlantis this way, but I also saw it like there was one of these openings I had was, again, we can call it a story, whatever. It's not important. It's more like what's behind it. I saw this temple way back in the time in the East where they used the sexuality through the tantric in a very pure and beautiful way where it actually liberated a lot of souls and enlightened a lot of souls. But suddenly, you know, it's like every peak when there's like a very strong light, at one point the darkness comes and goes over the light again. Sometimes those things happen. I see like everything is a cycle, you know, and it's the same with religions. As I see it, when someone experienced the divine, God, whatever we want to call it, that's not something you mentally just are capable of understanding. It's like an experience. So it's like you see the snake. You see, if the snake should be the symbol of God, for example, let's use that term. Then you have a prophet, you have Jesus, you have a saint or something that experienced that snake. And then suddenly that snake goes out to spread that to other beings for them to experience the snake themselves. But when the body of that saint drops, then what you have left is the mold. So then somehow the followers of that saint, they don't have the snake to experience. They have the mold to experience of the snake, which is not the full experience. And suddenly this starts to roll and then new illusion starts to come. And this is also how I see how the world is today. Also because it's like a polarity, right? This entire universe is a polarity. And when something really good happens, something really bad also has to happen. It's like the joy and the sadness is only for the mind to judge whether it's good or bad, but both things happen. So that's also the same, for example, when I have had past lovers or I've had past friends or something, where they started to put me on a pedestal and said, please take me off it. Please take me off it. Because I know if you put me up here, at one point you have to put me down here. It's like the polarity of life. Maybe not in this life, but then in another lifetime. And I don't want that. So please just put me off it.
This metaphor of the snake you just used, I think you're referring to the loss and revival of knowledge. You know, how a saint comes and there's a huge surge of enlightenment and then he dies. And then next thing you know, after a couple of centuries, people are being persecuted, you know, in the name of that teaching, or it's just gotten totally warped and distorted. So it kind of like knowledge crumbles on the hard rocks of ignorance. And it happens to whole societies as well as, you know, religious or spiritual revivals. Just keeps going in cycles, but perhaps growth is accomplished through cycles. And you can't just have, like you're saying, you can't just have the positive all the time.
No, exactly. Going back to the myth of Icarus, it's like flying too close to the sun and the wings is melting off. We need the cycles. We see that in the seasons also, right? Most places, at least. We need both. And that's very important. I believe so. I know the further I come out to feel the beautiful divine things that I cannot even explain by words. There's a lot of things I cannot explain. But I know when these things have happened to me, I just know, okay, there's a cycle now where I have to go as deep low. And I need to not judge that and just like embrace that. It can be very hard sometimes, but I believe so, 100%. I believe that the other thing is a bypass, for sure.
Shadow work. A couple of questions came in. Here's one from Natalie Butler in London. She said, I have been told twice that this is my first human life and that there are a few others here from the same place as me. I wonder where I would normally reside or incarnate.
So what's the question?
I guess she's wondering, if this is her first human life, where has she been for her other ones? Was she an animal? Was she on another planet?
Okay.
That kind of thing.
Of course.
Irene says, how would he know?
Of course, I'm not going to go into the individual, if that's okay, because that takes too much. I rather want to like focus on like the flow of the conversation.
Yeah, the principle of it.
Yeah. Of course, I also see that new souls comes down, but I also have to admit that it's not many souls that comes down in this time. What we could also call the Kali Yuga. Many of the souls came before that because it can be very overwhelming to come down in the middle of that like a soul and take form and not have the experiences before. But those experiences can also come from... There's many different layers of this, but let me just say that I don't see it like you have been an animal the last time, because it's another kind of soul they have. At the end, it's the same soul, I know, but animals, they have soul groups where they drop down in a group where there's a bigger soul and that soul has maybe 100 drops, which is the animal. They have a totally different game.
Like those birds we were talking about, they could, in a sense, be one big soul.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Or perfect a school example. Of fish or something like that.
Perfect example. And therefore, I see it as a lie. I see it as a big lie that they say out there that your grandfather can be the bee or the worm. But I also have to say, I also understand why it's being said. because it creates humbleness to the people to think about what they do with the animals. So I get the game. But from my cosmic point of view, I don't see it as, of course, it's possible. It happens that you can incarnate, but it's not something that really happens.
If every worm eventually became a human, we'd have a math problem. I mean, there are probably thousands of worms in our yard, but there's only two humans on this property. And that's true of the whole Earth. And, you know, if you count all the mosquitoes and the butterflies and everything else, there would have to be some kind of conglomeration. If those things have individual souls, they'd have to somehow conglomerate to join together in a mass to form the soul of a higher being, because the higher beings just aren't as numerous as the insects and whatnot and the fish.
Yes, exactly. And it's important to remember that there is difference. All souls, they have their own experience, and it's not only the human experience that actually is very beneficial. Yeah. All experiences on Earth is very beneficial, and that's also why we should be humble to all beings, because there's something to learn from all, because they all have a specific soul that comes with a certain kind of delicate wisdom. So yeah, of course it's possible that it's her first lifetime. I don't really see it that often, not before the Kali Yuga at least, because many souls, we need some time before that. If you meet these kind of souls, it could be people with very heavy autism or something, you know, where all the different worlds is very open and the senses is very, it's very hard to be in a physical body.
Because they haven't had much practice at it.
Yeah, exactly. Normally. Yeah. It's possible. But I also have to say, again, I'm not going to talk about this personalized question. So I'm not saying if it happened for her or so, but there's also many psychics out there who's saying this to people. I've had many, many people saying this is their first lifetime.
And the psychics have told them that?
Yeah. Past life readers saying, well, this is your first lifetime.
How would they know, really?
Yeah, exactly. You cannot say that because maybe you could just not see them.
You're saying that it's like the Cleopatra thing. Only one person was probably Cleopatra, and probably people having been born for the very first time as a human is kind of a rare thing, you're saying, and not as common as psychics would have you believe.
Yeah, but yeah. I see many people who believe it's their first incarnation. Especially they hear from someone, because many people, many past lives people say it out there, but you can also feel it yourself. There is something for that to dive into, because that can also be a karmic pattern that creates an illusion from your past to look into. And they can be very, very interesting to look into, because you can open up to a new kind of value from your soul that has been blocked because of a pattern that tells you, well, this is my first. Because there's something you might not see, which if you go in and look at it, you can open up to beauty for yourself.
You say you've remembered a lot of your own past lives. If you had to apply percentages, what percent were human? What percent were on some other star system or whatever? Can you actually answer a question like that?
No.
Okay.
When I had the opening, many of the past lives came to me. Those I know today. I have not been curious about the rest. Because I know if something comes to me, it's because I need it. And if I don't need it, it's the past.
It won't come.
So I haven't dived into it. It's not my priority. I rather want.
It's a hostess Twinkie.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, let's do another question here. This one is from Rita Sponenberg from Pennsylvania. A lot of this conversation is reminding me of the interview with David Spangler from years ago. David Spangler was one of the founders of the Findhorn place up in Scotland, who had all kinds of subtle perception of fairies and elves and subtle beings. The negative entities just needing to survive. He used the analogy of the sewage in his lake, the trees, when he was whacking the ferns and picking up on their reactions. So basically, this is a guy, and I've interviewed a number of such people, who was, from an early age, able to have subtle perception and see all kinds of things that people don't ordinarily see. And it's been the nature of his whole life. And that's why he was instrumental in the Findhorn community. I don't know if you have any comments on what she just said.
Nothing really pops up to me.
Well, it's interesting about whacking ferns. Do you find it difficult to navigate life sometimes because you feel the pain of, you know, you don't want to step on a bug on the sidewalk?
Yeah, I think I can very easily say that when I open up to other beings this way, I stopped eating anything from animal because I could not be with that pain. It was not possible for me to be with that pain anymore. I actually stopped with the meat before that, but I could not eat anything from it. because it was too painful. And I needed to figure out, like, what's up with the plants? How's the spirit working with this? And it took me a while to realize that the plants, they are also here to serve us in some ways. Right now, we are not in the place of that. But if there's one thing I could share about how I look at the future, because I'm pretty sure about this one, is that we come to a place of consciousness where we don't have to take a whole thing to kill it. We don't have to take carrot or something where we take the entire being. But maybe we pick oranges from an orange tree where the tree still lives, so to speak.
You're saying our food sources would be like fruit and things that don't kill the whole plant when we take some food from it.
Yeah, but we're not there yet. So as I see it, we came to a place, again, my truth, if people don't resonate with it, take it or leave it. But I saw that the consciousness, there was like a new kind of opening in the consciousness that happened around the 1800, where we learned not to need to kill animals. Before that, maybe we needed it to survive and such, but we came to a place where we didn't need it anymore. And therefore, it's not supposed to happen anymore the same way. But we're not in a place now where we can drop all the vegetables, so we can still eat carrots and such. But it's like we take it in steps, so to speak. That's how I see it. It comes in steps. And as I see one of the last steps, we can talk about the last step might be just like breathing air or just like catching sunlight, right? But before that, by still eating, I see it like we only borrow, so to speak. We don't take like a full living being. We only take that which still lives. So we don't take a full being. Yeah.
Yeah. Don't try living on sunlight just yet.
No.
No. No. Especially in Denmark in the winter.
No, that would be a bad idea.
And of course, even some meat-eating civilizations like the Native Americans were not wasteful, as I understand it, and they were reverential when they had to kill a buffalo or something for food. Yeah. They just killed what they needed. And then the white men built railroads across the West, and they would stop the train, and people would just shoot buffalo from the train and then keep on going. It was like supposed to be fun. And the, you know, the Native Americans naturally thought we were insane, and they were right in that regard.
Exactly. And that's also like one of the things that people often say to me, well, what about the Native Americans? Because they kind of killed animals. And I'm saying, well, the Native Americans, in my perception, had a very strong bond to Mother Earth and to all the animals. They probably know how to do it. I don't know it, so I'm not doing it. That's how I feel like.
And I'll say they didn't do it for kicks. You know, they didn't do it for sport.
No, exactly. It was a whole ritual and all these kind of things. I'm not saying that there's not places where that's needed anymore. That's not up to me to decide. But it's just like how I see it, that there's a consciousness that happens where we kind of stop taking from others. And also at one point, we will also stop taking from plants and only borrow to be in like full harmony, full balance.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, there are realms of creation where this is already true. I don't mean physical planets, but astral and celestial realms where I'm speculating here and you can see what you think, but where people don't need to eat physical stuff or kill anything in order to survive. And maybe if you're on a gross planet like the Earth, there will always need to be something of that nature in order to survive just because it's such a dense realm.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I agree with you. It's the consciousness growing and evolving. I just see it as we're going that way. We're getting closer and closer to that place where we don't need to eat, but we're not there.
Yeah, don't try to be a breatharian.
Like I just see steps.
What are some other things that we could talk about that I haven't thought to ask you that you would like to talk about? Oh, another question has come in. Question 3, Peter Falk from Italy. What do you believe is your first responsibility here on this planet?
That's a great question. I believe what I came to, at least until now, is that the cosmic consciousness that I have opened up to is something that needs to be conceptualized in the same way as you see other people with an opening where they create a concept, like you see with Rudolf Steiner or you see with someone else. It comes to me that my opening needs to be conceptualized for the future.
Meaning you have to build a structure of knowledge about it? You have to like be able to explain it, writing a book or something like that?
My opening came in a way that I didn't know what kind of words to use for all these kind of things. I needed to study words to understand what it is that I'm seeing and feeling and knowing out there, to understand what kind of words can somehow describe it from a human to a human so the mind can understand it. And I have fought this for a very long time because I tried to stay very humble in a way of why should I be someone that created this? But I came very, very recently to knowing that the more I try to judge my path of not realizing that there is something that needs to come out of this, then I'm just putting myself in suffering. Because it's not about me. I have the opening to help people if I'm back. That's my biggest responsibility in this lifetime.
Okay, so let me just elaborate on what you just said. So you want to codify the knowledge or write it down or record it in some way that can be conveyed to other people and thereby to enable them to benefit from it. And I presume that even like Rudolf Steiner, whom you mentioned, or others, it won't just be a matter of reading a philosophy, because we have a lot of those. It'll be something that they can take into their lives and maybe practice in some way that will bring about a transformation on a deeper level than mere intellectual understanding could do.
Yeah, exactly. It's somehow a bridge between the knowledge and experiencing it or embodying it, because that's what I basically do with the telepathy. I have the Akasha where the knowledge comes, but through the telepathy, I experience it and I get to transform through that experience. Exactly. It's very good elaborated. It's bringing the things together and somehow make that like a legacy. I don't know exactly how to do it yet because it might require some help. I have some students who's already working on it. Because of course, it's like what we talk about here is only a little surface of what it is that it actually possesses, what it contains, or I don't know what to call it.
Okay, so this knowledge, let's say, if you were to, let's say, write a book or a series of books or something, would there be a lot in those books that isn't already in other books that have been written throughout the ages?
No, because somehow everything, they speak about the same with just different words, right?
Nothing new under the sun.
Nothing new under the sun. And it will be the same here. I just need to find a new concept for, you know, the truth that I found. And I keep like diving deeper into like that experience that I have felt of that divine presence, like the same as the saints and the prophet. I'm not saying I'm a saint and prophet. I don't mean it like that. But it's like that kind of opening I have. I somehow need to conceptualize that for the mind to understand. But it's not something that is special on the first time on earth or something. It's like the same that you can find in many other books. It's just maybe different wording and a different kind of setup with maybe experiences and practices and knowledge and such.
I think that's really good. I don't think that any spiritual teacher who ever walked the earth invented anything new. And in fact, even before there were human beings on the earth, there were probably spiritual teachers throughout the universe who were saying the same thing. But there's a reason why people keep coming and having these insights, because it needs, only a new seed can yield a new crop. It needs a fresh infusion over and over and over again in every generation. I'm just putting what you just said into my own words to make sure that I'm on the same page. You just feel this calling to get it in writing and to systematize it, perhaps, so that as many people as possible can benefit from it.
Yes, that's the word. That was the word I was looking for. So thank you for finding that. I couldn't find that one. That's exactly how I feel. And I feel it like right now. I sensed 2 years ago that I will start to step more away from being a healer and more being the teacher. Yeah. And it just came to me and I felt, okay, I didn't know why actually, because I felt like the healing was trying, it was about to go good and there was flow. And I'm like, okay, so now I have to go down. I'm about to grow, but okay. It started to go down again. After I got that, the flow was not the same anymore. But at the same time, I started to have the students and all these kind of things. And it opened to me that it's because it's this path I have to go. I have to systemize something that people can follow. And yeah. One of the visions that I have is to have this book or this series of books or something that can help people, but also have a center or maybe a few centers in the world where people come and they can retreat and they can go into learning more about this, like a little community somehow.
Yeah, that's nice. And you can do all that stuff. You have plenty of time. You're only 29. You're about 45 years younger than me or something like that. So you have plenty of time to do all this stuff. Of course, you never know. We all might die tomorrow. And that would be okay, too, in the cosmic scheme of things. Yeah, I'm inspired by what you're saying and what you're doing. And I won't be around to see all of it, probably. But I think you're going to make a nice contribution to the world. You already are. And the thing about being a healer versus what you're now feeling called to do is you can only heal so many people. Not that they don't need healing, but it's kind of limited. If you can provide something that can reach a much larger number of people, then they can heal themselves with that.
Exactly. The big change for me, because I've known this for a long time, but I've kind of battled it because I was afraid if it was like a spiritual ego or something. When I walked around in India last time, when I was in India here, uh-huh, in the beginning of this year, I was walking and suddenly there was this sadhu, this holy man that just stopped me and said, "You're special, come here and sit with me." And then he...
Give me a few rupees and I'll tell you how special you are.
Well, he didn't ask for rupees, but he's just sat and he came and he said, "You have to come back every day, every night, because I need to tell you stuff." Bottom line, the first thing he said to me was, "It's a crime the way that you use your abilities. It's a crime. It's actually a crime the way that you don't take responsibility upon the opening you have." I didn't say anything to him. He just said, "Right now you're helping one-to-one person." And then he said, he used himself an example and said, when he began, he went out to the jungle and he meditated for 2 years. And then afterwards, people built a temple at that place in the jungle. He used that symbol for me to understand that there is a legacy that has to happen. It's not one-to-one sessions, right? When someone stopped me and just said that, I felt like, okay, maybe it's time that I take it a little bit serious.
That's interesting. And you never want to lose the one-to-one feeling too, because I don't know, it's a kind of a balancing act between broad reach and never losing the personal feeling for individuals. I've seen teachers who have a huge following who have come to believe that individuals are dispensable. The ends justify the means, and it doesn't matter if this person is discarded or this person is used for their money or for whatever. There just has to be that intimate personal love and compassion as if the person were your partner, even though you might have thousands of people that you're...
I agree. And it's actually one of the reasons why when I feel, for example, that right now I have to step way more into having students that can take over the legacy and go out, do the healing and such. But the thing is that I kind of attach myself to my students because I get so involved in their life. You know, I care about them. So if they drop me, I actually get hurt. I'm not neutral in it. I'm not like, okay, then just a new one. It's not how it is, because there's like an energetically exchange with my students, which means I feel them. And when that happens, of course, I also feel sad if they have to leave or something. It will be easier in some ways to only focus one-to-one sessions, but I'm still going to have one-to-one sessions. People can still reach out to me. I'm still going to do it. But my focus just apparently has to go the other way. That's something I have to prepare for.
Yeah, and it'll take a while. We'll see what the extent of your range of influence is. I mean, there are different people have different ranges. And sometimes a real small gathering can actually be more impactful than a huge thing. I mean, Ramana Maharshi just sat there on his couch with a few people staring at him, and you know, relatively small setup, but the impact he had is still rippling throughout the world.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And there's also a part of me that would love that, because I'm not sure how it will turn out for me if it would be like a huge, huge gathering, you know, with too many people, because I like to feel the pulse with people also. That's how I work with it. I would also love to still have like a private life where I can grow with like being a brotherhood and such. I'm not necessarily attached to it. It has to be something big at all.
Right. Another thing that happens is that when it does become big, then all of a sudden you have all these administrative hassles and monetary considerations and beautiful women coming at you. You kind of have a target on your chest. And a lot of spiritual teachers who've had big organizations have fallen prey to that. They've gotten caught up in the money and the women and all that stuff, even if they were monks who came out of India, especially if they were monks who came out of India. This kind of thing happens. So it's kind of like the bigger it gets, the more challenging it becomes. I know Adyashanti, for instance, he recently retired from teaching, and somehow or other, it really took a toll on him. I don't think it was entirely a health thing. He was experiencing a lot of pain, and the pain was very traumatic, and he ended up retiring from it. You know, there's always going to be temptations.
Yeah.
And you just always have to be careful. Like you were saying in the very beginning of this conversation, you always have to be self-scrutinizing and making sure that you're being true to yourself and true to the truth and things like that.
I actually feel like I've already been tested or like being trained towards this, because I have experience going out in the world and travel to do my workshops and feel like a huge gathering already happened. And, you know, the women, they become very interested in you and you can see there's a lot of money in it. So I've already learned from that moment, not in the way of like thousands and thousands, right? But still enough to see, okay, there is something here. Understand the difference between following the path and just let these things come and go, not come and go the way of like that. It just happens. It's not something with you and you should not go into it. It just happens. So I feel like I've already been trained some ways to this.
And yeah. You know, it's funny because you might have actually been a spiritual teacher in past lives. You might remember some such lives. Do you remember such lives? And how did it go? Did you fall in some instances or get persecuted or all that stuff?
Yeah. The short version is that the first thing I saw was the past 700 years where I've basically just been hunted down and executed.
Yeah, there you go.
And so that was pretty overwhelming to see. But I also saw the one where I actually fall in myself and left my wife and two kids to seek fame of spirituality. And that's the one that taught me today, because since I remember that one, I got the taste of how it would feel to follow the fame or follow all these kind of things. And, you know, it doesn't taste good for me. It doesn't taste good for me. I remember how it was in that lifetime. I don't want that.
Well, maybe all that stuff made a strong enough impression that you won't be tempted anymore.
That's how it feels. That's how it feels, at least, yes.
Okay, so we're just about up with our time, but I'd be happy to talk a few more minutes if there's something you want to say.
I think I want to share that where I am right now in my life is I'm opening up to take more students in, to spend more time on that, because I also feel like if I can contribute with helping people with this, opening up, can be even more people can be helped out there.
How are you going to do that? They have to come to Denmark? Are you going to set up Zoom calls or what?
Yeah, they don't have to come to Denmark, no. It's basically that we figure out where they are in their life and how often we have to talk. There's teachings monthly. There is guidance. We text and we are in communication every week and often doing like what's happening.
With so a bunch of individual students.
Yes, it's a big word, but it's what I've been called to do. So that's what I'm going to do. No questions asked. So I'm opening up to that. And at the same time, I'm also in a place right now where while I'm doing that, before I systemize all this, which will be pretty big work, I'm very open to come out and, you know, in the world and do workshops to help people enlighten these things that I'm able to help with at least.
So somebody listening to this, let's say they live in, I won't say Pittsburgh because you've already done that, you know, Sedona or Boulder or any place, London or Italy or whatever, they could get in touch with you and they could maybe set something up and you would go there and do your thing.
And I will do workshops and I will do healings for sure. So because I'm in a place right now where I'm free and I'm capable of doing these things, and I just want to use that in a way of being more in service everywhere where it's needed. I'm open to talk with people about it if they feel a call for it.
So I'll be linking to your website. You do have a website now, don't you?
No, I don't. Oh. Because I changed it. And I'm not sure if I should have a new one yet. Because
well,
it's
you
like,
have to have a way of getting in touch with you. I could link to your Facebook page. I could put your email address on your BatGap page if you want.
Yeah, the email address. Otherwise, right now, I focused on my Instagram because there's too many places where people contact me. And honestly, some of it, technology is very weird with me. There's many emails that doesn't go through. And when I have an email, there's many problems. So I'm trying to not have too many platforms.
Yeah, okay. So we'll talk about that afterwards and I'll link to you however you want. You know, in 10 years from now, it might be a completely different thing. So if I'm still around, which I hope to be, I'll change it on your BatGap page. Okay. Maybe we'll be doing another interview by then.
Yeah, we can talk about it, but I'll be interviewing
Sri Lucas G.
Yeah. That'll be something. Yeah. I can easily create a webpage where people can reach me. Yes.
All right. So people who are listening to this can just look at your page on BatGap and whatever means we determine for them to contact you, they will find there.
Yes.
Alrighty. Well, thanks, Lucas. I've really enjoyed this. I've enjoyed getting to know you. I feel like I said in the beginning, I already know you in a weird way. I have a feeling of affinity with you, as I'm sure a lot of people do. We'll be in touch and look forward to seeing, you know, what you do with your gift.
Thank you, Rick. It's been an honor for me also and a pleasure to be here with you, because I really resonate with your perception of life and spirituality. And I believe it's very important to meet those people so we can have this beautiful flow together and, you know, contribute to the healing of everyone. It's been grateful for me too, and I'm happy to be here. And yeah, thank you for it. Thank you for the opportunity.
Oh, you're most welcome. It's an opportunity for me also.